of the island were weightless, balanced on its narrow midsection. The air cools in no time, although the scree is still warm underfoot. Descending, they pass a broken helmet, a snapped oar, the perfect skeleton of an 8-foot fish. Ragged wind, utter silence. The cliff looms behind them like a suspended wave. "We really are on the floor of the sea," Condry says aloud. No one answers, and he wishes he had not spoken. He is not sure why. Deeper, lower. A rowboat, one oar and two boots inside. Salt crystals coating the whole of it like frost. A bed of fossil oysters. A camel's skeleton. Long legs, white cage of ribs. It is almost cold by the time they reach the first island. It looms black and sullen before them, a round hill that outlived the sea. They grope and stumble around its base, littered with smooth stones and ancient driftwood. Mektu gazes up at the island.
"I smell bird shit."
"You're a crackpot," says Chindelin.
"He's right, I smell it too," says Eshet. "Something's nesting up there. Eagles or vultures. It would be a safe place to raise chicks."
Condry can almost feel his brother's smirk. They are rounding the second island when the moon peaks above the horizon. Soon a tattered silver ribbon gleams before them over the wastes of salt. "Our feet walk heaven's path," thinks Condry, mirthless. The third, hourglass-shaped island is even taller than it looked from afar. Standing close to its concave sides, countless tons of rock and earth above his head, he cannot help but imagine it collapsing, burying them, although of course it has stood that way for eons. He leans his head back, gazing at the distant summit. Who lived there, before the rivers were diverted, the sea left to perish in the sun? He collides with Mektu, who has stopped in his tracks. 100 yards ahead is a large cluster of men, passing swiftly among the boulders at the island's foot. By the moonlight, he cannot see them well. They bear no lamps or torches, but Condry thinks he sees the glint of steel. It is almost funny, the way the four of them dive for cover, squeezing behind a barely adequate rock.
"Gods of death, they got here before us," says Mektu.
"It can't be a wolf pack," says Condry.
"Can't it?" says Chindelin.
"Garatajik said that the prophet was certain you had outside help. Maybe in her mind that meant horses, saddled and waiting to take you east. She could have sent a force into the Yskralim at full gallop from the legions in the south."
"If she thinks we're assassins," says Mektu.
And Eshet says,
"Thinks?"
Condry, with infinite care, leans out from the rock. Nothing has changed. The men have not stopped moving, or sped up, or started in any new direction. He leans back with a sigh.
"Whoever they are, they haven't seen us," he says. "Angst hears, let's keep it that way. But we also need to count heads."
More careful glances. Condry cannot be sure that he has seen more than 10 figures. Mektu puts the number at 20 or 25. But even with the telescope, it proves impossible to say. The men pass in and out of view too often. Already they are vanishing, deeper among the rocks and ridges surrounding the great island. Within minutes, the last of them is gone. But not far gone, Condry knows. The open seabed between the islands is a paltry distance, something that could be crossed in one determined charge.
"We should fall back," he says. "As a matter of fact, we should find ourselves a hole and dig in. We can't take another step until those bastards leave."
"What if they dig in?" says Mektu.
"Then we're food for jackals," says Chindelin. "If they dig in, it means they think we're somewhere close. We'd have to try to flee along the rim, north or south, until we find a staircase or a ladder, and hope to hell it's not guarded."
"Or stay right here," says Condry, "until more of them come up behind us, and they start turning over every goddamned rock." He shakes his head.
"We can't wait for that to happen, and we can't just run. We need to move at the right moment."
"If it comes," says Eshet.
They retrace their steps, until the lower slopes of the island close around them. After half an hour of searching, they find a deep cleft in the hillside, out of sight from both east and west. It is no ideal shelter. By noon tomorrow, it will offer no shade. But noon is a long way off. Condry takes the first watch. As the others roll themselves into blankets and cloaks, he climbs with great care to a ledge some 20 feet up the hill. There he crouches, hidden by a shoulder of rock, peeping out at the moon-washed island across the flats. Nothing moves. The salt wastes make him imagine fields of snow. He has never seen snow, except for a thin midwinter gleam on some distant peaks of the coastal range. He has heard it said that there are mountains in the world where the snow never melts. It seems an outlandish claim, but then he has never seen any other mountains. How many can he even name? There are the lush blue mountains of the north, which some call the jewels of Uroth. There are the teeth of the dead, a dark rumor from desert stories, and perhaps no more than rumor. And there are the titanic peaks Arikina had somehow heard of, and in which she passionately believed. The night fires, climbing range upon range behind the city of Khosralis. Khosralis. The great city-state, the invincible city, fortressed in unbreachable walls. The last living shard of the Khosraji Empire. Condry tells himself that he is certain. Arikina is there. No other place in Uroth could have drawn her away from her clinic, from her beloved valley, from him. What has she become in these years he has wasted on war? A surgeon? Possibly, but she could wield the scalpel before she left the valley. Her passion was medicine, the science of cures. She would be serving the poor of Khosralis. They must have their poor, didn't everyone? Or testing their blood and bile in some old imperial hospital. Perhaps she had found work with her hero, Dr. Tsirim, the one who inspired her with talk of the city in the first place. Tsirim. Condry sits up with a gasp. A puzzle piece of memory has just snapped firmly into place. The satchel from Garatajik, the twice-sealed envelope, letter of introduction to Dr. T.R. Fesjamu. Tsirim Fesjamu. Gods of death, their allies. That letter is for Dr. Tsirim. He had forgotten her last name. He'd only heard it once or twice, but Tsirim, that name he carries like a scar across his heart. You could say they'd met. Condry heard her speak before a large crowd in the valley. She spoke of the throat rust, or as she called it, the world plague. The crowd had liked her jokes. So we're resistant to the plague here in Uroth. The world calls that a miracle. I don't. The Outlanders had to leave a little luck behind. If they'd tried to steal any more from us, it would have sunk their ships. She spoke of grave things lightly, even irreverently. She had visited the bleak memorial to the thousands executed in the Theater of Bones, and reminded the crowd that it was the noble, cultured, civilized Khosrajis who had built that palace of death. Your enemies, the Vajeks, merely carried on the tradition when the empire fell. Savagery is not the province of the poor alone, my friends. Never believe that. Never believe a man can't be a grotty little strangler just because his nails are clean. She was, save for the prophet herself, the most charismatic person ever to bother with a visit to the Satapre. When her speech ended, a crowd of 90 escorted her to the next town, all of them aglow with the vision she'd shared, an educated Uroth, out from under the quarantine, taking its rightful place in the world called Ispralal, which only on that day did he learn meant Island in the Stars. His family was there. Diakra sang a song about the triumph of the humble. The old man smiled without craftiness or irony, and the smile took 20 years off his face. Only Condry was miserable. In the doctor's presence, he felt a jealousy that left him witless, melting with rage. He knew why. There was no mystery. She had touched the one thing in all the world Condry could not bear to think of sharing. Arikina's heart. Dr. Tsirim was brilliant, dedicated, strong. She barely reached Condry's chin and had a face like a squirrel monkey, but her voice could blow the roof off a barn. She revealed nothing about her clan origins, but spoke of years spent among the Shoal, and they were enemies of the Vajeks, so Tsirim was all right. Who could have guessed, besides the old man maybe, who was nearly as well-traveled as the doctor, that she had come from Khosralis? She had stopped in Blind Stream for one reason, to meet a young nurse who was attempting something remarkable, an open clinic, where no one was barred from treatment or beggared by the charges when the treatment was done. A clinic where you paid in proportion to your wealth, the most outrageous idea ever heard of in the valley. That nurse was Arikina. Her clinic, just 6 months old, was already near collapse, for even the rich of the upper Satapre were not very rich, and the doctors were not pleased with what they took home. But Tsirim loved the idea, and since she had already impressed the best minds in the valley as a genius, her praise transformed the clinic's fortunes. Arikina's too. She and Tsirim had huddled for an hour before the doctor's speech. That night, after the great woman's departure, Arikina came to Condry and flung herself into his arms. Her eyes were moist, but she was laughing. She was going to become a doctor. She was going to change the world. She would finish her studies in Nandipatar and visit the Zavacindran missions and acquire the new translation of the great Anatomica of the Khosraj. She would become, thought Condry, the Tsirim of the Satapre Valley. "I'll help you," he said. She took his face in her hands and kissed him, long and deep. Condry held her stiffly. He was frightened by her intensity, and at the same time aware that it was the very heart of why he loved her. Urathi legends spoke of a well that led to the world's fiery heart, from which heroes came to drink before embarking on a journey or attempting great deeds. Arikina might be kissing him, but it was heart fire she tasted. And it was Dr. Tsirim, not Condry, who had led her to the well. "You've gone to Khosralis, haven't you? Wait for me. Look for me." Arikina would have laughed at such talk. "You don't even know if you're coming to Khosralis. You don't know where it is." "I'll find it." Condry can almost see her in the darkness, her slender shoulders, the mirth and joy in her gestures, hands never at rest until she dropped unconscious, dark eyes as urgent as a deer's. "If you're strong enough," she would have answered, "if you're ready to be wise, if all that lust and yearning has made you into someone the world could need." She was so much harder than his drill sergeants. They just shouted and punished. Arikina challenged him with love. "Kiss me," he tells her. "I can't, fool. Stop dreaming. I'm not there." So he does stop. Immediately, a thought of danger takes her place, and he knows he has avoided it too long. Water. By his count, they are carrying 25 fasca, including the 7 from the soldiers they killed. It is a dreadful weight. Condry has never marched with more. But can it possibly suffice? Even traveling after sundown, each of them will need a full fasca daily just to keep moving. Any less, and the deadly fatigue that comes with thirst will slow their pace. Condry had hoped they might cross the Iskralam in 5 days. Eshet says 6 or more. 6 days, 24 fasca. If all goes smoothly, they should make it with one to spare. But what if they are forced to linger? A full day? 2 days? They will drink less in hiding than on the march, but they will still drink. "This time tomorrow," he thinks, "if we don't start by then, we'll have to turn back, into the jaws of the beast." The wind rises. Its chilly hands probe his clothing, find 100 paths to his skin. By the time Chindelin relieves him, the moon has sunk low. "Condry?"
"Hmm?"
"Condry? What is it, Mech? Why aren't you asleep? The Prophet may think we're assassins,
hired assassins. But that's not all. She thinks we're doing the will of the Yatra.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
And what if she's right? I don't know why I stabbed Garatajik. There's no reason I should have.
Of course there's a reason. You thought he was going to cut off my head.
But I heard him talking. After he fell, I realized that I'd heard quite a lot about his hatred of Ojulon, the things he'd learned in the East.
You heard that?
And I stabbed him anyway.
Piss of the devil. All right, you heard something, but you weren't clear about it, that's all. We were in terrible danger, and there was no time to think. Anyone could have done what you did. I might have done it. Is that good enough for you?
Shut your eyes, Mac. Go to sleep.
How did you know they were open? I didn't.
Can you feel my eyes, brother?
No, idiot. But don't you lie there fucking staring at me!
What if I'm the one, Condry? What if I've been carrying it all along?
Mac, how can you stand being you? I mean, for even one day. If you were carrying the Yatra, you wouldn't be talking about carrying the Yatra. And if I had it, I wouldn't be talking to you this way either.
Yes. Yes, you would.
Oh, Pitfire. So now you think it's me?
I think it's traveling with us. I can feel it pushing sometimes, like a thumb.
A thumb.
Like a dry thumb groping for my eyes.
At daybreak, Eshet spots a hole in the side of the island, just yards from where they've slept. It is no more than a 2-inch gap between hard stone and drifted scree, but a few minutes of digging with a chunk of driftwood reveals the mouth of a long, narrow cave. Chindelin makes a few exploratory stabs with Condry's machete, then lights a match and leans inside.
No ghouls, he says. In fact, there's not a blessed thing inside. A lovely little sea cave, that's what it is. Ong's handed us a gift.
The cave is less than 3 feet high. Condry looks at the dark hole, and his old fear growls a warning. He turns and gazes across the seabed. The strangers have not reappeared. Survival before stupidity. In the cave, they will be out of the sun.
I'll keep watch, says Eshet. I can't sleep again so soon.
The men eat a quick breakfast, then crawl one by one into the cave. The floor of the cave is fine, cool sand, so comfortable that Mektu and Chindelin groan with pleasure as they stretch out. But to Condry, the space is almost as horrible as the grave tunnel in Boulanger. His heart pounds. He wakes quivering, over and over, from whatever shallow sleep he achieves. Cries escape him, waking the others. Chindelin asks what in Jekka's hell he's so afraid of, and Mektu says with unusual sharpness to leave his brother alone. At last, it is Mektu's snoring that dispels his terror. All the years he fell asleep to that horrible noise, a pig drowning in its slops. At times, he would wake Mektu with a kick and then deny it. Today, the noise soothes him as nothing else could. He shuts his eyes and imagines the deep water that once filled this cave, the tug and billow of it, the vanished fish and octopi and eels. After their fight over the bushwife remark, Condry and Mektu opted for peace. It was a loveless, utterly strategic choice. Everyone in the household was watching them. Mektu even claimed that the old man would beat them if they didn't appear to be getting along. Condry didn't want to believe that his father could be so dreadful, but he realized to his shame that Mektu was in a much better position to know. The old man had spent a great deal more time with his Blindstream family than up on Candle Mountain. So Condry agreed to call his wound an accident. He had slipped in the bathroom, struck his head on the sink, and Mektu agreed to let him sleep on his floor. In the presence of others, the boys put on a show. They were delighted with each other. They were friends. Condry struggled with this performance. He was still furious with Mektu and disgusted with his snoring, and Condry was an awful liar to boot. In the bathroom mirror, he forced his face into a smile and recoiled at his own demented look. But his brother was a natural. Everyone believed in his joy. Condry can still recall Mektu's effortless transformations, bitter contempt in the hallway, warm goodwill and a hand on Condry's shoulder when they reached the kitchen door.
"Can I borrow 3 Rhoda, Mother, if I make it up in chores? I want to buy Condry a lemon roll. He's never tasted one, and you know the shop runs out."
Such easy kindness would last until the door shut behind them. Then the coins and the smile would vanish into Mektu's pocket, and there would be no more talk of lemon rolls. Mektu was so convincing that Condry caught himself feeling grateful. He had a new brother. He was loved. Until they were alone again, he could forget that it was a lie. But a lie sometimes evolves in the direction of truth. 3 weeks after Condry's arrival, Mektu began to forget to sulk when they were alone. Then, very cautiously, he began telling jokes. Condry laughed, even at the worst of them. He thought it was the least he could do. One night, the brothers were lounging on the porch roof, gained from Mektu's bedroom window, another privilege that had been his alone, looking out over the valley at the lights of 7 villages, faint pools of lamplight in the darkening valley. It was early summer. They lay back eating chaffa nuts, drowning in the tireless din of tree frogs, and catching whiffs of the water pipe the old man was sharing with his cronies below. The stars were few and hazy. The younger children were already asleep. Mektu told a long tale of their war with the boys in the village of Sharp's Corner, 2 miles downhill from Blind Stream.
"They're older, and they fight better, too," he admitted. "One of them kicked Batali in the nuts. His children will all have squeaky voices. That's how it works, you know."
Condry winced.
"Poor Batali. You have to stand up to them," said Mektu. "Always."
"I will," said Condry.
Mektu studied him doubtfully. "Don't be frightened," he said at last. "Remember, there's a lot more of us."
Indeed, the Hingemans were an enormous family. 2 adjacent houses belonged to uncles, and there were cousins beyond counting seated across the valley.
"We're all fighters, Condry. The women, too. You should see Aunt Ingla make a fist."
"I can fight," said Condry. It was the simple truth. He had blackened eyes, and worse, among the hardscrabble mountains boys. What shamed him was the guilt he felt, the longing to beg forgiveness of those he punched or kicked or threw to the ground, to pray for them in the temple. It was an awful weakness. Small children felt such remorse, not men of 14. The night deepened. Mektu plucked fireflies from the air, held their wings, licked their glowing abdomens until his tongue blazed green and ghoulish. He urged Condry to do the same, and Condry did. The residue of the insects tasted like soap and made his tongue feel dry and foreign. Mektu was pleased.
"Now I'll show you my treasure," he said, and pulled Condry to his feet.
Like monkeys, they scaled to the roof of the main house, leaped light-footed into a cypress tree, and from there descended to the wall between their own courtyard and that of the nearest uncle.
"Don't fall," Mektu whispered. "His dog will wake the whole goddamned town. Also, there's slugs."
Condry had good balance and didn't mind the slugs, which oozed like butter through his bare toes. His only fear was that the fireflies might make him vomit up their dinner, a birthday dinner for their sister Deera, and the finest meal of Condry's life. They crept on. Mektu pointed to a small, neat house down the hill from them, where the road made a hairpin turn.
"That's Uncle Chindelin's place. You know about Chindelin, don't you? The old man's best friend?"
Mektu looked as though the question had never entered his mind.
"I suppose he is," he said. "But that's not what matters. He makes weapons. He's going to make me a sword."
Condry blinked at Mektu, a thin, crooked boy with glowing goo on his lips.
"When?" he asked. "What do you mean, when?" "Soon enough. Don't be stupid."
The wall led to other walls, and then to a much larger structure, which Condry had admired since the day of his arrival. It was a bridge connecting nowhere with nowhere, rising in great symmetrical arches over the folds and ravines of the Satapre Valley. Greenery cascaded down its sides. Bats whispered over and under its immensity. The boys stood some 15 feet below its upper surface.
"Aqueduct," said Mektu proudly. "It used to bring fresh water down to the port. Now it's my secret road."
"Did the Kasrajis build it?"
"Must have. There's a heap of rocks near the sea called Old Palace, and that's where the aqueduct ends. Be careful, will you? Every year someone falls off the aqueduct and dies. We're forbidden to climb it. Let's go.
There were footholds. They scaled the ruin and walked in darkness above the village, the pigsties and rice paddies, the great amphitheater of the valley rushing down toward the stage of the sea. Mektu roamed ahead, impatient with Khandri's awe. Now and then he'd turn and whisper, "Hurry," with a green flash of tongue. Blindstream village ended, and the wild margins of an apple orchard brushed the foot of the aqueduct. Mektu said they would come back in autumn and scavenge for fruit. They passed the seminary and the fish farm. They passed the New Life Orphanage, where 40 years earlier the tiny girl who became the prophet had learned to fear the tread of the priests. A dancing white ribbon was the moon on Moti Lake, and then the outskirts of the next village began. Its name was Sed Hemen, Blessed Dell, but Mektu called it Chegemen, Yawn of Boredom, because it was very religious and proper, and its girls were not allowed to climb trees or wade in the river or kick a ball in the road. The first dozen houses were whitewashed and joined together like cells in a hive. The aqueduct passed very close behind them, although it was choked along this stretch with more greenery than ever. Khandri looked down through the tangled brush.
"You could piss into their gardens," he said.
Mektu pulled him back from the edge.
"Don't even joke about that," he hissed. "And don't make a sound unless I do. I've never brought anyone here, you understand? Not even Batali. If you mess this up, you're not my brother. I don't care what the old man says."
Shocked, Khandri could only nod. Mektu studied him another moment, as though reconsidering a gift. Then he nodded and smiled broadly. Khandri smiled back, suddenly aware that Mektu wanted to share his secret. Whatever it was, he was tired of guarding it alone. They passed two houses, then dropped to hands and knees and crept, with infinite care, into the brush. A third house slipped by. Then Mektu stopped. Beside him was a narrow path through the foliage, right to the aqueduct's edge. He motioned for Khandri to look. They were behind the fourth house, large and rather shabby, with few windows and a back garden in need of a trim. The wall about this garden was 10 feet high and crowned with broken glass. Solid brick, it ran alongside the vastly larger wall of the aqueduct. The alley between them was some 4 feet wide. Khandri glanced at his brother, lost, but Mektu was searching the weeds. A moment later, he placed a rope in Khandri's hand. Thick, wet, grimy. Mektu gave a sharp tug. One end of the rope was tied fast to something deep in the brush. Khandri ran his hands along the rope. It was knotted at intervals. Mektu took it back from him and fed it down the aqueduct's side into the narrow alley between the walls. He descended, bare feet gripping the knots. When he beckoned, Khandri followed. He was afraid of making some noise, enraging Mektu, ruining his life. But seconds later, his feet met the ground. The alley was weed-choked and damp. In one direction, it simply dead-ended. In the other, it ran some 20 feet and cornered left. Mektu put a finger to his lips. They crept to the corner and turned. Now they were between two private gardens, and the ground at their feet was smooth stone. 30 feet ahead was another dead end. Mektu led him forward, urgently now, and Khandri felt suddenly ridiculous. What were they doing here? What if they were discovered, mincing around puddles on tiptoe, two clowns pretending to be thieves? A smell of wood smoke met his nostrils. Then he saw that the last 6 feet of wall on the left-hand side were made not of stone, but of wood. Broad planks covering what must once have been a passage into the shabby garden. Mektu touched the planks with his fingertips, like something cherished. He tugged Khandri to his side. There were small gaps between the planks, but Khandri could see nothing through them but darkness. His brother grinned and cupped his hands around Khandri's ear.
"Now we wait," he whispered.
Khandri looked at him and shrugged. "What for?" Another whisper.
"It may be a long wait. Maybe until morning. But you'll thank me when it happens."
You'll see. So they crouched and waited. It rained a little, and Condrey grew wretchedly cold. It was then that he made the acquaintance of a doubt that would needle him for years. What if his father had kept them apart out of kindness? What if Mektu was simply mad? Of course, there was no escape tonight. Condrey had given his word. He squatted, freezing, and even held his jaw to keep his teeth from chattering. The night was endless. Bells tolled, dogs barked and fell silent, fat toads hopped in the alley with a sound like flung mud. After a while, Mektu put his arm around Condrey's shoulder and they huddled together, cold as toads themselves.
"I didn't mean it," whispered Mektu. "You're my brother and I'll always take care of you."
"Thanks," whispered Condrey uncertainly.
"I was only 9 when the Yatra came. I thought it would kill me, Con. In fact, it promised to kill me."
"What's a Yatra?"
"Ask me in the daytime. The point is, I'm sorry. I'm ashamed of myself. Just remember, I'm on your side no matter what."
He hugged Condrey tighter, and Condrey hugged him back, nervous but glad. Then voices sounded from behind the wooden wall, and Mektu looked up with a predator's eyes. The voices were female. An old woman's rasp, followed by the low, lilting voices of 2 young women or girls. They were hushed, as though trying not to wake others in the house. Soft footfalls, jangling keys. A door creaked, and yellow lamplight blazed through the cracks in the wall. It slashed across the brothers' faces, and for an instant, Condrey felt utterly exposed. But they were quite safe, for the cracks were extremely narrow. Too narrow to look through at all unless you pressed your eye to one of them, which was, of course, exactly what they did. Beyond the wall was a bath chamber. It was much like the outdoor chamber in their own house. Wooden bench, smooth flagstones, a bamboo door that could be latched from the inside, and of course a raised water tank, with a horizontal pipe some 7 feet off the ground, ending in a spigot. But there was something odd about this tank. A long iron box was built into its base, with a heavy door and small holes along the side. From a few of these holes, smoke was drifting. A firebox, thought Condrey, astonished. Hot water for bathing. Why don't we have one of those? Papa could build it with his eyes shut. An ancient woman with a white nest of hair stood in the chamber, raising a lamp above her head. A servant, Condrey guessed, and none too happy about the hour as she struggled to hook the lamp over a nail on the wall. Succeeding at last, she hobbled from the chamber and returned with an armload of firewood. She opened the door of the firebox, poked and grumbled at the coals, and shoved a great quantity of wood inside. The flame leaped, and the old woman's face became visible, thin and creviced like a wooden puppet. Then she slammed the door and walked out. Soon the other voices came again, murmuring and laughing. The door reopened, and 2 young women in heavy cloaks stepped into the chamber, carrying folded towels. They were dark and slender, with great gleaming eyes, and their cheeks and foreheads were nearly identical. Sisters, Condrey thought. They were older than the boys, 1 18 or 19, the other a few years her senior. They were recalling someone's antics, mimicking a ponderous male voice, covering their mouths when they laughed.
"Moral correction. He spilled the wine on my arm. Did you see him? Did you see his face?"
When they removed their cloaks, they were naked. Condrey felt as though he'd been flung into the sea. Breasts. Actual breasts, and bellies, and 4 buttocks, and dark, mysterious hair. The younger sister sat down on the bench and drew her feet up, and she was barely 2 feet away. The older sister raised her hand to the spigot. A fall of water, a puff of steam on the flagstones. She plunged into the water and gasped with pleasure, and Condrey thought he would weep. His face was flushed. His penis was larger and needier than ever before in his life, peaking like a bald infant above his pants. The younger sister rose and shook out her braid, and black locks cascaded to her thighs. Stepping to the bamboo door, she called softly,
"Aren't you coming, dear?"
From the house came a muffled,
"Yes!"
The younger sister turned back to the older.
"Get out, you greedy thing. Save a little for Ari and me."
They traded places. The older sister wound a towel about her head, then put her cloak on wet and left the chamber. The younger sister talked to herself as she bathed. When she finished, she moved nearer and dried so exquisitely between her legs that Khandri found himself communing with the gods. If he moved or breathed or blinked, he would explode. His ejaculation would be accompanied by drums and trumpets that would wake the neighborhood, the village, the valley. But the gods kept him silent, and he praised them, praised this holy bathing place, praised his dear brother and the invention of thighs and nipples and other beauties for which he had no name, and the gods told him his life would be unbearable in its sweetness, and they scalded him in arms of living gold. The woman put on her cloak. Khandri fell from the stars. When he caught his breath, he saw that a third figure had entered the chamber. She was still robed and her back was turned, but he thought she was younger, perhaps just a year or two older than the boys themselves. Like the old woman, she was reaching for the lamp.
"What is it?"
said the one who had sent Khandri to heaven.
"A moth,"
said the new girl, standing on her toes.
"It's going to burn to death on the glass. Let it burn. Oh, don't!"
The girl blew. The lamp went out. The older girl whined in protest, but the newcomer said,
"Don't be silly. There's light enough."
She pushed open the bamboo door, and the older girl padded carefully toward the house.
"My cousin Ari, savior of moths. What if they feel pain?"
asked the new girl. She undressed, but they could not really see her. Mektu wrung his hands in frustration. The girl was a flaw in the darkness, a tease of movement, a trick of the eye. And sounds. Khandri heard her small gasps, heard the water break and change against her body as she moved. And soon, too soon, the closing of the spigot, the slap of her feet on the stones, a sudden creak as she sat down on the bench. There came a thump, which Khandri felt more than heard. She had flung herself back against the wall, against the very board to which his cheek was pressed, and in the same instant burst into tears. Mektu gripped his shoulder. "Don't move an inch." But the girl did not sense their presence. She wept a long time, hidden from her family, hidden from the world. Khandri still could not see her face. That first night he never did. But he felt the storm of her misery, the board trembling slightly with each pitch of her shoulders, and the water trickling from her body passed under the wall and wet his feet. Then it was over. The girl stopped crying and felt her way into the house. The boys retreated, shadows among shadows, and no one was ever aware of them, not even the uncle's dog. Back in their room, Mektu was triumphant.
"When they bathe at sunrise, you can see everything," he said. "But the old aunt goes first, and she's horrible. You want to scream." "Oh, gods, Khandri, we have to plan something. If I don't talk to her, I'll die. Not the aunt. I mean the sister with the braids. Ong, have mercy. I must be the first man ever to see her naked. That counts for something. I'm going to write her a poem. Do you think you can put a dick in a poem?"
Khandri was only half listening. Visions of naked flesh still danced before his eyes, but his thoughts were with the youngest girl. "What do you think she was crying about?" he asked.
"That one?"
Mektu shrugged, pulling on his nightshirt.
"How should I know? Girls cry. Maybe someone told her fortune and she didn't like what she heard."
"At the party?" Mektu looked at him. Then he buried his face in a pillow and laughed.
"You oaf!" he wheezed. "Those are the Nawal sisters. They don't go to parties. They were coming from the temple, from a destiny service."
Khandri's face was blank.
"Don't you know anything?" says Mektu. "Twice a year, the holy farts in Chegemen make their daughters sit up all night praying for rich husbands. That's the destiny they're after. The priest, Father Mars, will stay up too if you pay him enough. He's a creepy old lizard, that Mars. He chants and tells the girls about married life and douses them in rice powder and cloves. That was Mars they were laughing about.
Moral correction. He says that a lot. Papa hates him, you know.
Condry sank to his place on the floor. But that last girl, she's not old enough for a husband.
Old enough for you, though, said Mektu with a wink.
Condry flushed, dropped his eyes. But after a moment, he gave Mektu a nervous smile.
Yes, he said. I like her. I wish I knew why she was crying.
I'll introduce you, said his brother, magnanimous. But don't get your hopes up. She must be 17.
I couldn't see her.
Neither could I. That fucking moth. But I know all about that girl. Vitaly's sister made friends with her at school.
Mektu yawned enormously, snuggling down into his bed.
Her parents abandoned her in Nandipatar. She lived on the streets for years. She went hungry. She begged. Then an old nurse took her in and they lived together in a shack behind the hospital. The nurse tried to bring her parents before the law to get some money for the girl's education, but the parents picked up and left for the cotton towns in the dead of night.
That's strange, said Condry.
Strange and bad, said Mektu. Kids die on those streets, but the Nawals are all right. When the nurse died, someone sent them a message, and the old lady went to Nandipatar herself. And they're well off, too. That girl's problems are over.
It didn't sound that way, said Condry.
Mektu shrugged again. They say she's clever. I wish we could see in the dark, like foxes. Her name is Arikina, I think.
An urgent hand on his shoulder. Condry wakes, bolts upright, strikes his head on the ceiling of the cave. He curses. She hisses her sympathy. He starts to lie down again.
Don't, she warns. Get up, come outside. The men out there are leaving. We have to decide what to do.
He rolls over. From the cave mouth, a weak gray glow.
Devil's ass, it's after sunset, he cries. Why did you let me sleep so long? You looked tired.
Condry squirms out of the cave. The others, still and low among the rocks, are peering east into the twilight. Chindelin points, and Condry sees them, just to the left of the big island. Once again they carry no torches. They are moving north with good speed.
We almost missed the bastards, says Chindelin. If they'd waited another 10 minutes, we'd have never seen them at all.
Still no idea who they are? Says Condry.
None, says the smith. But at least we have a head count. 12 of them out there.
They move like Grodhins, like distance walkers, says Eshet. And they are heading away from us. That's good. I do not wish to meet them.
Damned right, darling, says Mektu. I'm sure who they are.
That's a wolf pack.
Condry gazes up at the sky. The minute it's fully dark, we go, he says. We should reach the next island by moonrise, and maybe get farther than that. Let's just hope they're alone.
No landmarks after that next island, says Chindelin. How do you plan to keep east?
By the stars, uncle, says Condry.
You know your stars that well?
Condry nods. The old man, he says, and Chindelin's mouth spreads in a smile.
You should have heard Condry complain when he dragged us out to stargaze in the cold, says Mektu. How could anyone get lost in this country, Dad? Uphill is the mountain, downhill is the sea.
And he said you wouldn't live in the Satapre forever, I suppose?
The brothers look at each other, and Mektu bites his lips. In fact, the old man had said that the Satapre, like any place, would find a way to kill a dreamer or a fool. His eyes had fallen on Mektu as he spoke. But it was not Mektu who had nearly proved the truth of the statement.
We should hurry, says Condry.
They lace their boots, pass a fosca around. Condry watches their horse-like drinking and feels a tightness in his chest. They have lost a knight, and he is leading them on. Into what pain, none can guess. But he knows that every mile they walk could be a mile they will have to retrace, defeated, sick and feeble with thirst. And that soon enough, they will cross that invisible line beyond which no return will be possible. In the near darkness, an object catches his eye. He picks it up, a long, heavy wooden brush topped with wiry pig bristles.
What the hell is this? He demands.
That? Growls Chindelin. Why, that's a long-handled camel brush, of course. Because every fucking fugitive needs a long-handled camel brush. Or so your brother tried to tell me when I went through our packs and took inventory.
I didn't know it was there, says Mektu. The bush kits were so well packed, I didn't want to pull everything out.
Chindelin points to a mound of objects near their packs.
Boot spurs, for instance. Don't pull them out. Hoof picks. You'll miss them if they're gone.
He starts to kick at the pile.
Riding crop, leather punch, a spare saddle pad.
Condry is stunned.
We just ran with all that?
Mektu hides his face in his elbow.
And see here, the best of the lot, says Chindelin. A jar of tablets. What kind of tablets? Fucking salt.
They bury the useless gear and smooth the ground above the hole. Then they set out. It is now so dark that they can see little more than the black outline of the island against the stars. As they draw closer, more and more stars vanish behind the looming cliffs. Great irregular boulders ring the island like forgotten toys. But there are more than boulders, he sees now. Strange walls surround the island, knobby and misshapen, like hedges abandoned for decades. Some have crumbled to knee height, others rise 10 or 20 feet above their heads. Only by probing with his fingers does Condry realize what they have found.
Coral, he says, awestruck. This island had a reef about it.
Mektu laughs, incredulous, but the smith's voice is low with amazement.
Feel those sharp edges.
Condry's right.
A reef's exactly what we've wandered into. Jashar, it must have been beautiful here.
What is a reef? Asks Eshet.
They move gingerly into the once-living maze, passing through gaps torn by boulders, now and then scaling the sharp coral walls to check their position. Condry glances at Mektu. Does he remember those fishing excursions with their cousins by the sea? The dark curve of dolphins breaching? Schools of lindfish turning the waves to sudden gold?
Check as hell, look up there, says Chindelin, pointing.
To Condry's amazement, there are buildings atop the island, framed darkly against the stars.
Didn't you know? Says Eshet. People lived here, Chiloto people. There were fishing towns, temples, and older things, towers, fortresses, from the days of the Empire.
I wish you trusted us, Eshet, says Mektu. I wish you'd say why you know so much about...
He stops dead. His head goes up and he sniffs.
Don't you smell that? He says.
Now Condry smells it too. Wood smoke. Faint but unmistakable. He licks a finger and holds it high.
The wind's from straight ahead, he says. Gods of death, there's more of them, says Mektu.
At once, the specter is very real. More killers from Eternity Camp, close by, waiting to pounce. Where to flee? Where to hide? How will they keep from being spotted in the moonlight once they light out across the flats?
Maybe it's not the army, says Eshet.
I'll bet it's not, says Chindelin. Why would they light a fire? The Rasanga aren't that stupid. They want to surprise us, not warn us away.
Then who's out there?
Says Mektu, looking for some reason at Eshet.
Merchants? A salt caravan?
Eshet shakes her head.
Salters have no reason to come here. Even if they're selling to the prophet, they'd be a day's ride further south, where the cliffs are lower. They could be miners. Some say there's gold under the stolen sea. Or looters, poking through the dead towns on the islands, taking whatever they can sell. Or just Tirmasil.
She speaks the final word with obvious loathing. Condry glances at her, startled.
Tirmasil? He asks. Bandits of the desert. Filth.
He waits, hoping she will elaborate. Mektu, oblivious, rakes a hand through his hair.
The fuckers!
He blurts suddenly.
What are we supposed to do now? Turn back?
Like hell we will, says Chindelin. We don't know one thing about them. but there's all kinds of death behind us, that's a fact. Let's have a peek at them. If they're dangerous, we'll double back around the island to the south. If not, we'll tip our hats and press on. No one likes the plan, or has another to suggest. They creep closer. As they move among the rocks, the smell of wood smoke grows, along with a stronger smell. It is roasting meat, Condry realizes, but some gamey, even slightly revolting meat. Dog? Horse? Camel? He cannot place the scent. But even as he wonders, they round a wide boulder, and firelight stabs their eyes. They fall back instantly, then look again with great caution. In a large natural clearing in the crumbled reef, six men are standing beside a fire, drinking from tin cups, warming their hands. They are all armed, knives, clubs, a few battered scimitars, but they do not look like soldiers. They are lean and pale and obviously poor. Hollow eyes, short, untidy beards. Their desert canoes little more than rags. One man, slightly taller than the rest, wears 20 or more silver rings on each ear. The fire burns in a wide circle of stones. Above the flames, some animal, a bird, it seems, is roasting on a spit.
"Scrawny fellows, aren't they?" whispers Chindelin. "That's a relief."
"They don't have bows," says Condry. "How the hell did they shoot down a bird?"
"And what a bird," says Mektu. "It's the size of a goose, but it smells all wrong. But I want some."
"Be quiet," hisses Condry.
"Fuck, they heard you."
But it is a false alarm. Something else has caught the men's attention. They have all turned suddenly to stare at a point somewhere off to the left. The man with the earrings makes an amused gesture with one hand, and the other men laugh aloud. He's in charge, Condry thinks. With great care, he leans out a bit farther, and silently curses. 30 feet from the campfire stand another four men. Three are very much like the first six, but one is a pale giant with enormous hands and an expression of casual menace. Their bearing, although slovenly, has something about it that reminds him of army constables. He hazards one more inch. "There," he thinks. "I knew it." Beyond the four men burns a smaller fire, guttering and quailing in the wind. This fire burns in the lee of an overhanging boulder, but it is failing nonetheless. Beside the dying flames lies a man wrapped in a dark cloak, utterly still, and above him, gazing with fury at her guards, stands a girl. She cannot be more than 18. She is short and broad-shouldered and quite obviously strong. She wears a man's tattered trousers and even more tattered coat. The right sleeve is missing entirely, revealing a powerful dark arm. Her face is wide, her eyes bright and slightly bulging. Her large mouth is curled in a sneer.
"Spakad! Kuhali Spakad!"
she bellows.
"Taya,"
replies the man with the earrings, pointing at himself. The girl makes a sound of contempt.
"Oh, you're the doctor now? You lying pig! You can't treat your own fucking sores!"
A general argument erupts, partly in Khosraji common, partly in something Condry cannot understand. The girl is clearly demanding aid for the man at her feet, and by her gestures, more fuel for the fire. The men look both sly and uncomfortable. They show her their empty hands, or laugh, or point to the man with the earrings, who appears to speak for them. 10 armed men, a crazed girl, another man dying at her feet. Condry slips back behind the rock.
"At least it's no ambush," says Mektu.
"I saw camel dung at the clearing's edge," says Eshet. "Fresh dung. It was steaming."
So there are more of them, somewhere, and camels as well. Mektu slides over, making room for Chindelin. And then it happens. 2 metal somethings in their gear smack together, with an almost laughably audible clink. A shout goes up from the men in the clearing. Blades clash on blades, a challenge.
"Salt rats!" shouts one of them. "We have 30 men here. You want to try your luck?"
Condrey steps out from behind the rock, hands raised high. It is their leader who has shouted, but all 10 have weapons drawn. The girl, too, is staring at him, rage and confusion in her eyes. She is not one of these ruffians, he decides. Her accent, her face and color all belong to some other clan.
The gods keep you, shouts Condrey. We're not salt rats. Not a danger to you, either. We didn't know you were here.
A Tau? Who the hell is that?
Shouts the girl. She turns to Condrey.
Are you a doctor? It is Pakad?
All of you, come out into the clearing, shouts the man with the earrings again. But keep it slow, or by the buried saints, we'll cut you down. There's 30 of us.
You're repeating yourself, thinks Condrey. What are you scared of? The travelers step out into the clearing. Eshet raises her hands like Condrey. Mektu looks at the bird on the fire and grins. But Chindelin hefts his axe, staring ferociously at their leader.
You want to think very carefully before you fuck with us, he says.
Uncle!
Cry both brothers, whirling. Eshet jumps in front of the smith.
God's peace,
she cries to the strangers.
My husband is very protective, but he means no harm. We bless you as trail brothers. Tom iti Tom.
Condrey looks at Eshet, impressed. Husband. Quick thinking. Her words, especially the final three, have an immediate effect. The men look at her with great surprise, and a few of them even smile. The man with the earrings turns uneasily to Chindelin.
Why didn't you say you were Parthen? He asks.
Condrey looks the men over.
Parthens? These wretches?
He has never met a member of the Deep Desert clan, but those who have use words like proud and formal. Neither quality is much visible in these men. Condrey turns to Eshet.
Is that what you're speaking, the Parthen tongue? Is that what you are?
My husband is not Parthen, says Eshet. But Avrama, brothers, peace. We have no quarrel with you.
Nor we with you, unless you've come here to steal, says their leader.
He gestures again with his scimitar, and several men ease reluctantly around the travelers to slip among the rocks. After a moment, they return, shaking their heads.
No one's back there, Atau, says one of the men.
Just the four of you, lighting out across the Iskralem, says the man with the earrings.
Are you mad?
Where are your camels? Where the hell do you hope to get?
Once again, he addresses his remarks to Chindelin, as though his status as husband leaves no doubt that he leads this band.
Ah, well, just away, mutters Chindelin. Away east, to the Lutaral, if we're so fortunate.
But why cross the Iskralem?
There's a fair path on this side as far as the Arikoro, and a road from there to Mab Makutin. It's much longer, to be sure, but there are wells to drink from, and villages, and food.
We're in a hurry, says Condrey.
A hurry to die, maybe. This is a terrible place.
The strange girl gives a cry. The men jump and raise their blades. The girl is on her knees, talking to the motionless figure beside her, touching his face. One of her guards, the pale giant, crosses quickly to the group's leader and whispers in his ear. The giant is smiling. The man with the earrings listens, his face impassive. At last he appears to reach a decision. Sheathing his blade, he turns and waves his men back from the fire.
Come here, then. Warm your bones, he says to the travelers.
You're right, woman. We've nothing to fear from each other. Tom iti Tom. They shuffle uneasily forward. When they are quite close, the man bows to them stiffly.
My name is Atau. Forgive us this welcome. We have been dealing with madness and death.
You're Parthens? Says Chindelin dubiously.
Atau laughs with sudden force.
Come now, old man. You married a Parthen, but cannot tell them from a mongrel like me? No, I am not of the desert blood. My roots run to 6 different clans, and not one of those people sees enough of themselves in my face to claim me as their own. Do not pity me. There is always a family for those without family, if you care to embrace it. That is where I choose to belong. For my boys, the tale